Chapter 3. Cambridge. Cambridge, a university town built in a featureless flat landscape. So featureless and flat, you wonder why anyone chose it as a location for anything. The magnificence of St. John's, the noteworthy splendour of Trinity, the sheer portliness of the Backs. And gazing at the magnificent, noteworthy, sheer splendour of the portly King's College Chapel, it would be a world-weary traveller indeed who did not pause to think, why the fuck didn't they build the whole town 2 inches to the right? A fair, if somewhat rudely couched question, to which an answer may be found only by turning back the clocks of time. Let us imagine it is the year 1282. An urgent message arrives at the court of King Edward I. Most noble sire, I have built a bridge over the River Cam. The royal reply, dispatched with all regal velocity, reads, whatever for. Thus, the enterprising but foolhardy pontifect was left with a bridge on his hands. Since it was apparent to everyone that this newly constructed thoroughfare, leading as it did, from nowhere in particular to nowhere else at all, was a fumble. Occasional passers-by would point and mock, saying, who's the bloody fool that built a bridge here? I don't know, must be wrong in the head, he would reply, puce with shame. For years he sat by the bridge, wearing a weak smile, until, one autumn, he was hit on the head by a golden delicious. Eureka! He barked, evenly, with a Job-like disregard for time and place. Then, in a daze, he made his second big mistake. Rather than building some decent restaurants, a couple of pubs and a laundromat to attract human beings to his bridge, he hit on the rather dull idea of erecting some very high walls behind which a semi-aristocratic elite could hide from the outside world and go to each other's rooms for sherry. This was an extract from the Reverend E. W. Shepherd Walwyn's The Bridge Over the River Cam, 1884. It is the year 1958. A Ford Anglia is juddering south along the A604, containing Chief Inspector and Mrs. Chapman, and a rather spotty figure precociously dressed in the kind of suit that he thinks doctors might wear. We arrived at Emmanuel College. I left two quivering parents and attempted to saunter past a lot of very important-looking people in gowns and stared around the courtyard. I could see no sign of a master's lodge. Overawed by the portly magnificence of the groups of overtly musing academics, I asked an old gardener where it was. He told me. I found the door. But I was a quarter of an hour early, so I walked around for a time, trying not to look conspicuous and wondering why everyone was staring at me. At last it was 4 o'clock. I knocked on the door and was greeted by the gardener, who asked me to come through to his study. I said yes quite a lot and nodded, particularly when he was talking about the history of coal mining and the Industrial Revolution. But when asked whether I was going to pass my A-levels, I gave a definite no to physics. He was clearly impressed by this and, at last sensing a possible argument, thrust forward his head, raised his eyebrows to the point of nearly covering his bald patch, and asked, why not? Well, I'm not sure. Not sure? That means you're in doubt. Well, yes. Do you mean yes? Yes. So a pass is quite possible? Yes, possible. Probable even? Well, let me put it another way. Are you going to fail? No. Good. Then we'll see you in October. I left and stood for a moment in the corridor, trying to work out whether he had said yes or no. I decided that it amounted to an almost definite yes. Walked back through the courtyard, feeling that it was mine already, and was rather annoyed that no one was staring at me. How did it go? Said the Anglia. Oh, fine. Mind you, I've got to pass physics. Will you do that? It said. Won't you? Yes, I replied confidently. The engine choked a few times and then purred into motion. I think we licked them this time, said Flying Officer Edith, casting a victorious eye over the fast disappearing seat of learning she had come to hate during her 1¼-hour ordeal. Chief Inspector Biggles opened the throttle. He relaxed back into his seat with a satisfied grin as the familiar drone of the 927cc engine sped us on our way to eternity and sandwich spread on toast. A week later, I was beginning to have my doubts. Could the man really have said yes, just like that? Would the rest of the college back up a gardener's judgment on my admission to Cambridge University? I was glad that while waiting for written confirmation I had been accepted by 2 London teaching hospitals, more realistic goals for a Melton Mowbray Grammar School OIC. At St. Swithin's Hospital I had been submitted to 20 seconds of searching questions. Dean. Do you play rugby? Me. Yes. Warden. We've got a John Chapman here. Is he any relation of yours? Me. Yes, he's my brother. Warden. Right, see you in September. Dean. Wait a moment, what position do you play? Me. Second row. Dean. September it is, then. St. Mary's Hospital, if anything, was much tougher. I was seated in a room with a 110-page intelligence test to be completed in 15 minutes. An official started the clock and left me to it. After 10 minutes, I was still less than halfway through, and, as always, in moments of panic, I thought, "Steady on, old man, you are English," and stopped. I lit my pipe and stared blankly at the clock for a whole minute. Picked it up out of curiosity and toyed with it and put it down again. Somehow or other, it now seemed I had another 10 minutes to spare, which I thought I might as well spend completing their test. "Hang on, aren't you cheating?" I asked myself. "Yes," intelligently I replied. After lunch, I returned for my interview. As I entered, the two interviewers flinched, because as far as they were concerned, they were looking at a person with an IQ of 495. They blinked a little nervously and fell back onto the only line of questioning which they thought could outmaneuver Einstein and Bertrand Russell rolled into one. "Dean, do you play much sport?" "Me. I'm very fond of mountaineering, but I've only led a few very severe climbs, and I'm not very experienced on snow and ice work. I play second row for Melton Mowbray Rugby Football Club, first team, and my brother is captain of the first 15 at Barts, though despite being 6'4" tall, I'm faster than him over 100 yards, having clocked 10.4 seconds at the age of 15 and a half. And I was second in the All England Amateur Athletics Association 440-yard competition last year, the winner of which was Malcolm Yardley, who equaled the European record of 40.1 seconds. I limped in a poor 3 seconds later, but it's not really my distance. I only entered out of curiosity. They apologised for not being able to think of any other questions, and said that unfortunately they would not be able to offer me a professorial chair for another 7 years, although it would be there for asking if I could bear to wait that long. So, by the end of the day, I knew I could have a place at either St. Swithin's or Mary's. I was still uncertain about Cambridge, but felt just sufficiently euphoric to join my brother later that evening at St. Swithin's, where he was holding his 21st birthday party. The next morning, I woke up from a drunken coma to find myself inexplicably back in my bed in Melton Mowbray. I stumbled downstairs to breakfast. Perhaps yesterday's events had all been part of a drunken dream. But they couldn't have been. I definitely remembered my brother congratulating me on being accepted at St. Swithin's. That was why I'd drunk so much. I sat down to face breakfast with a spinning head and a mouth that could have been a British Rail ashtray. There was still no news from Cambridge. Suddenly, there was a bellow from the direction of the front door of our house, which stood in the not particularly portly grounds of Melton Mowbray Police Station. My mother swept into the kitchen with a white envelope, gripped in the King George V Jubilee commemoration zinc envelope tongs. The jaws of the great tongs parted, and the envelope thuffed onto the blue formica breakfast table. "It's from Cambridge," she shrieked, feigning nonchalance. "Kiss me, Hardy," I said, and broke the seal of my fate. I read the letter 4 times, looked out of the window for a moment, and read it again. "What does it say?" said Edith. It says... I went outside, walked around the house twice, and came back in to read the letter again. It had gone. There was nothing there. "Oh, well," I thought, "may as well finish my breakfast. You're mad, Chapman. We haven't got any zinc envelope tongs. You're thinking of the Edward VIII abdication mug, which will be very valuable one day if we keep it long enough." The letter was genuine. I had been accepted by Emmanuel College. And I ran away and hid for the entire summer looking after a herd of goats in Caton Bay. I had passed all my A-levels and was very pleased to get 65% in physics and an amazing 185% in chemistry. Unfortunately, I'd been taking the exams of the Oxford University Board, which were regarded with snotty-nosed contempt by the University of Cambridge. Apparently, no one knew anything about chemistry at Oxford. They were all too busy lounging around in bottle-green velvet suits, holding lilies and quoting lines by Tim Bryden and Dennis Keate. This meant that I had to take a separate exam in organic chemistry. And so I stood, facing a bench covered with apparatus I'd never seen before, in a vast brown hall. I wasn't alone. There were some 40 other nervous candidates at similar benches, soiling their cavalry twills at the mind-boggling array of jars containing alien chemicals. 40 brains turned to dry ice as the invigilator stepped onto his podium and started the competition by saying, "Gentlemen, you may now begin." For 10 minutes I tried to look as if I was doing something, moving bits of apparatus, taking the occasional apparently casual glance at the examination paper. After 11 minutes of this useless activity, I realized that I didn't know how to do a single experiment. For the first time, I experienced the full force of an attack of ignorance. Ears full of cotton wool, eyes staring into a tyro-blenching void, legs that wouldn't move. Time seemed to stand still, although a strange feeling in the nape of my buttocks told me that it wasn't. Bang! Someone 2 benches away had apparently exploded and was being covered in an asbestos sheet by the invigilator and 2 attendants. Bang! Came from behind me as a young gentleman from Hong Kong ran for a fire extinguisher. Then, bang! As fragments of a Liebig condenser flew around the room like shrapnel. Now I knew why they had brown walls in there. Stop! Everybody stop! Right, if I find any more of you bloody idiots heating up ether over an open flame, I'll kill you! I haven't been a munitions expert in 2 world wars to get slaughtered by a load of ignorant tits. If you don't know what you're doing, get out! This didn't have a calming effect on anyone, but it did interrupt the trance-like state of the student opposite me, who began putting chemicals into a beaker. He measured out some pale blue liquid with confidence, added some white powder, poured in 5 cc's of a colourless solution, placed it over a Bunsen burner, and the contents of the beaker went a rather pleasing shade of orange. The man knew what he was doing, and I followed every move he made. I looked round to see what everyone else was doing, to double-check. After a series of manipulations, we both finished up with a greyish, powdery residue. From the wording of the question, this should really have been white, but I was quite pleased at having any residue at all under the circumstances. However, my helpful friend wasn't satisfied with the impurity of his product. He must have the best. And reaching for the ETH... BANG! The next time I took organic chemistry, I was completely confident. Everyone appeared to be watching me, and I was no longer frightened by the brown walls and the immense array of bottles and chemicals, and got a perfectly white crystalline substance. The same invigilator was present on his podium, and seemed much calmer, less imposing than the year before. He didn't even mind the odd bang. I expect his wife was no longer unfaithful, or he'd had his piles removed. I wasn't surprised that I passed. After all, I was at Cambridge. I'd bought a gown, several club ties, walked around in a tweed suit with a pipe and tried to look clever. The pipe was very useful because it meant that if anyone said anything I didn't understand, I could puff on it and seem incredibly deep in thought. The tweed suit didn't fool anybody, but the pipe worked a treat. In tutorials, I was asked fewer questions. It also helped clobber the stench of formalin in the dissecting rooms. This is one of the many hurdles in medicine. The first is dissecting a worm, a dogfish, and a rabbit at school. Then your very first real dead human being. I got over them, and within 2 weeks I was conveniently using my cadaver's mouth as an ashtray. My tutor in physiology, Professor McKenna, was a Scotsman who now lives in Dunedin, New Zealand, so obviously you would use the word doer in describing him, but it wouldn't be true. He was a tall, fat, randy bastard with a goatee beard and a very agile mind above it. Again, at tutorials, we all giggled at Hibben, and the other 4 of us were rather glad that he took up so much of the professor's time by questioning him. So he very rarely got round to discussing our essays. Footnote. Essay, a collection of other people's thoughts disguised to look like one's own, in the judging of which originality is heavily penalised. After about 5 sessions, Professor McKenna became irritated with our tittering and rounded on us and said, "I like Hibben. Unlike the rest of you, he knows how to ask the question why." A habit that gets knocked out of us by parents at a very early age when it should be a gift to be nurtured. We crept out with our notebooks full of humility. It was one of the few really important things I learned at Cambridge. But I still think I'd know more about the physiology of the human body than the urinary system if Hibben hadn't asked why quite so often. Professor McKenna's little lecture had inspired him to ask why at every possible occasion, and he often astounded ordinary passers-by by asking them why. I wasn't aware that rabbits were capable of making any noise until I slit one's throat while it was nailed down in the physiology lab. I realised that the animal was technically dead, in that its brain had been mushed up by a probe and so could feel no pain. But I and my partner James Wellwood were a bit surprised when it raised its head from the block and squeaked. After a few puffs on our pipes, we plucked up courage and slit its chest open to find a rather disturbingly pulsating heart, which we courageously linked up to various pieces of apparatus. Could this be vivisection? Yes, we thought. But soon it all became fun. Don't get me wrong, I'm not anti-vivisection, but I am anti-unnecessary vivisection. I've seen none of that in this country, the United Kingdom, that is, but I did see rather a lot of rats slaughtered at a medical school in New York, where a newly qualified intern was fiddling around with rats' brains without any apparent explanation for his action. He said he thought it was something to do with the pineal gland. So, what's a rat? They do the same thing with human beings there, with volunteer prisoners, who, if they agree to have something alien inserted into their bodies, not just bits of plastic and metal, but untried drugs, get reduced sentences. In this country, on the whole, we use medical students as guinea pigs. I have never entered one of these contests, and I'm glad, because a friend of mine took part in a double-blind trial on a drug that brings down your blood pressure, only to find out a year later that it could cause permanent impotence. He was lucky to have been given the placebo. In my first year at Cambridge, I tried to join the Footlights Club. Realising that the only reason I'd gone there in the first place was that I'd seen Jonathan Miller performing in a television version of a Footlights annual review. As a fresher at the Society's fair, I went from stall to stall in my houndstooth check, pork pie hat and pipe. I didn't join CUCA, QSOC, or Evangelical Aero Modelling, but I did join the Medical Society, the Mountaineering Club and other important political organisations. Eventually, I arrived at my destination, the Footlights stall, behind which was David Frost, a lone figure boiling underpants. He told me that nobody could join, since it was by invitation only. I questioned the point of the stall. "None at all, really," said David Paradigm Frost. "We only have 25 undergraduate members per year, so push off." So, I hadn't been invited to join the Footlights, the only purpose of my university career. Neither had Tony Branch, who'd come to Cambridge to read law with the intention of switching to the light entertainment course after one term. We organised a smoking concert, or smoker, a kind of cabaret review where people in dinner jackets and black ties sit around laughing at themselves. Satire. I'd invited the secretary of the Footlights, David Frost, the president of the Footlights, Peter Bellwood, Tim Brinton, a radio personality, Niall Marsh, The Gardener, D.H. and Frieda Lawrence, Lord David Cecil, Lord and Lady Clit, the Earl of Penis, and Sir Roger Lupin. We gave them gallons of claret and didn't start until they drank at least a bottle each. The show, just as we thought, was successful, and we were both invited to go to a Footlights audition before the committee, in the hope that they would allow us to appear in one of their smokers, which was a sort of second audition, where you had to kind of sort of be awfully sort of funny. I impersonated a carrot, and a man with iron fingertips being pulled off stage by an enormous magnet. In the same set of auditions, John Cleese did a routine of trampling on hamsters, and can still do a good, pain-ridden squeak. We were both selected, and very soon we were able to wear black taffeta sashes with Ars est celere artem on them. The art is to conceal the art. And as members of the committee, we were able to prevent all sorts of talented people from joining the club. The Footlights Club at that stage had had members the week before, like Jimmy Edwards, Julian Salad, Jay Miller, B. Gascoigne, The Goodles, Noel Coward, Irving Thrush, Cole Porter, honorary, Mr. and Mrs. Not Arthur Askey, Leslie Bricus, and Tarquin Thing, who wrote all the Beatles hits and posthumously curtsied at Muhammad Ali when he thought he wasn't looking. Oh, and also Peter Cook. Although by then Peter had gone down from Cambridge, even in those days he had an obsessive disregard for David Frost and came back to punish him by being funnier and more intelligent at the smoking concerts. I remember one particular sketch where Peter was talking as the keeper of the Holy Bee of Ephesus, where he explained to the pilgrims that the Holy Bee was kept in a matchbox, but that it could cure all ills if they placed 3 shekels through the lid. After they'd given the 3-shekel piece, and weren't cured of even one ill, he explained to them that they'd probably stunned the bee. Peter got rather angry with God during this routine, frequently cursing and pointing up to heaven because he had so many complaints from customers. And at one moment, he went white, and left the stage clutching his chest. Either he'd forgotten his lines, there was a God, or he'd overeaten. But the most important thing about the Footlights Club was that it thought itself a more elite group than even the Footlights Club. The Middlesex County Cricket Club had nothing on them. They wouldn't even allow His Royal Highness the Prince of Wales in to hoover the carpet. This taught all the members the kind of supreme arrogance that made Genghis Khan what he was yesterday. The Footlights' final examination took place over 2 weeks in June at the Arts Theatre, Cambridge. And if you earned a distinction, You would be offered postgraduate work at the Oxford Playhouse and the Travers Edinburgh, pick up a PhD at the Lyric Theatre, Shaftesbury Avenue, followed by a lecture tour of New Zealand and culminating in a full doctorate on Broadway. Our exams were open to public scrutiny. They were rigorous and cruelly fair. If you got laughs, you passed. If not, you failed. Compared to these, the university exams were about as reliable a guide to a student's ability as the width of his mother's kneecaps, and I treated them with the nonchalance they deserved. Around me, others were going mad with the terror of failure. The strain was too much for one gentleman on my staircase, whom the head porter found throwing his own shit about the room. He made a hell of a mess of the place and was carried off screaming. I think he got an aigretat, which means that he got his degree, but didn't have to take the exams because of illness. Two other aigretats were less genuine. One law student, who had done no work at all except on bottles of claret, hired a car and had himself driven out into the middle of the fens, where he was found a week later wandering around in the fields, claiming that he had amnesia. In case he's forgotten, his name is... well, I'm sure he hasn't. Another friend, who was reading Oriental Studies, had spent his 3 years at Cambridge flying aeroplanes. He faked appendicitis, and because his two main papers were several days apart, was brave, stupid, or afraid enough to be slit up and have a perfectly healthy organ removed. I left Cambridge with a BA in Natural Sciences, lower second class, several bottles of college sherry, and a PhD in claret.